thanks for the nice intro and thanks for inviting me. It's been a long time since I was in Waterloo, so it's really nice to be back. I guess I should say, you know, so as you said, I split my time 50-50 between academia and industry. So from anyone's perspective, I'm 50% the enemy and 50% on the right side. We disagree about which side. Worried about my sponsors. Facecraft is actually paying the flights for this trip. So, and indeed this work was done at Facecraft. So this is all I'm gonna say about Facecraft, founded by myself, Ashley Montanaro, John Morton, who you may not know, he's an experimentalist. But you probably know Ashley. And you know, we work on trying to get quantum algorithms to work on actual real near-term quantum hardware, which is extremely challenging and interesting. And this work kind of falls into this. It was done on my Facecraft time. So here's where I'm going. I expect I will get to here and run out of time. And all of this, we'll see. It depends how many questions you ask. So I've given this talk a couple of times now. One time, the audience asked so many questions, they actually covered all this material in the questions, and it was great to have slides to go to for that. And another one, I went through it fast enough, and I did get mostly through it, but then another time I got here and stopped, so we'll see how it goes. But feel free to jump in and ask questions, and I might.
Question, how come Ashley is the CEO and not you?
I'll take that one offline, Graham. And the chair here might want to mute Graham at some point. I know Graham. Good. So, but feel free to leap in with questions. And it doesn't matter. If I don't get here, that's fine. If I get to here, I'll have covered everything that, like, the core results. Okay, so let's start with the start. This work is related to actually trying to construct ground states of quantum many-body systems. So, we're given some description of a local K-local Hamiltonian. So each of these local interactions in my Hamiltonian acts non-trivially only on k qubits. And, you know, we're given a description of this Hamiltonian by just giving it the matrix elements of its local terms, say. And the ground state problem that I'm going to be discussing is not to estimate the energy of this, but to actually construct the ground state of H of this many-body Hamiltonian, or at least a good approximation to it. So I guess, strictly speaking, the precision to which I want this an approximation of the ground state should have been part of the input as well. Okay, so I'm giving a description of a many-body Hamiltonian, a local Hamiltonian, let's say, and I want to output a quantum state that's a good approximation to the ground state. And I'm just going to generalize this slightly. The Hamiltonian might have degenerate ground states, so I don't care which ground state I get, or even if I get some mixture over the ground state. So I want, if I've got this is pi sub zero is the ground state projector, then what I want to output more precisely is a density matrix that is a good approximation to some state in the, or has good overlap with the ground state subspace. So trace against the ground state projector is close to one. Okay. So that's the problem. This problem is important. It's important to people even in industry. A lot of high performance computing budget is spent in industry on trying to solve the problem of understanding properties of the ground state, obviously not constructing a quantum ground state because you don't actually have quantum computers that are big enough to do this yet, but of constructing a classical description of the ground states and then understanding its properties. And there's really like a genuinely a big problem in designing new materials, in looking at optimizing processes and chemical processes. This is a problem we spend huge amounts of HPC compute power on. And in scientific research, this is also a problem that crops up everywhere. So people spend a lot of time trying to solve this with classical algorithms and quantum algorithms, but we know it can't be done efficiently. We know that this problem, famously in quantum information theory, we know that this problem is QMA hard, right? Because approximating the ground state energy is QMA complete, and if you've got can output the ground state, then you can estimate the ground state energy. So we know this is exponential time in a quantum computer, and despite what many papers on the archive might claim, there are essentially no physical assumptions on the Hamiltonian, so no natural physical assumptions or conditions on the Hamiltonian that you can put that make the ground state problem easy. So, I mean, you can assume it's frustration-free, you can impose that it guarantee that it's got a constant spectral gap, the local terms commute, the density of states is polynomial. This gets you down to NP-hard, and which means it's something we still expect not to be able to solve efficiently on a quantum computer. We don't expect NP to be in VQP. The reason for this is simply that the problem is hard classically. So all of this if you construct a classical Hamiltonian that's an encoding of a SAT problem, it has all of these properties. Frustration-free, if you're going to ask a question about that, about frustration-freeness, there's a slight, small proof to go from the classical problem to how you get frustration-freeness, which you can ask me about if you want. Okay, but the problem is really important. So people have, despite the fact that we know this problem can't be solved in general efficiently, people have nonetheless devoted a huge amount of effort to solving it efficiently, including developing a whole bunch of quantum algorithms for this problem to prepare ground states of quantum many-body systems. This is the table of some of the methods. So there's adiabatic quantum state preparation, where you adiabatically drag the state from some trivial Hamiltonian, ground state of a trivial Hamiltonian, to the one you're interested in. Quantum phase estimation, imaginary timed evolution, infamous or famous VQE, variational quantum eigensolver. All of these have their advantages and disadvantages. QPE, actually, if you think for a bit, classically, to find a solution for a SAT problem, there's a trivial exponential time algorithm. You just like guess at a solution and check if it's the solution and keep guessing. Expected exponential number of tries, you'll happen upon it. It's not so obvious what the quantum generalization of this naive brute force search is. And in fact, if you think for a bit, phase estimation is the quantum generalization of classical brute force search for this problem. But there's another algorithm that was invented quite a long time ago called the dissipative quantum eigensolver. And all of these algorithms have various trade-offs and benefits and disadvantages. So let me talk about the dissipative state engineering algorithm. So this was originally proposed in a paper by Fastrata, Wolf, and Sirak back in 2009. And there's also a paper by Barbara Krauss, Wolfgang Dürer, and others that was closely related to this. That paper had three results in it, three different results. One was ground state engineering. So they called it dissipative ground state engineering. So this is constructing ground states of many-body Hamiltonians via dissipative processes. One is constructing matrix product states, PEPs, and other stabilizer states, and generally some classes of tensor network state dissipatively. And the other was doing universal quantum computation via dissipative dynamics. The first of these is exponential time, their algorithm. It had better be, otherwise, because it's QMA hard. These other two are polytime, and they're different problems. They're really interesting results and not relevant to this talk. So they proposed an algorithm for preparing ground states of many-body quantum systems, dissipatively, that it takes exponential time, as it has to, because it works for a large class of Hamiltonians. But their algorithm works for frustration-free Hamiltonians. So let me recap what a frustration-free Hamiltonian is. So many of you will have seen this already, but frustration-free means that the global ground state, so the ground state of the entire Hamiltonian, is also a ground state of each local term individually. Like the minimum value eigenvector of the overall matrix is also the minimum eigenvector of each of the terms in the sum individually. And it's not difficult to show that for any frustration-free Hamiltonian, you can always efficiently and without loss of generality transform it into a sum of projectors without changing the ground state.
Is there some criterion I could use to decide if something's frustrating?
Thanks, Graham. No. It's at least QMA1 hard, and if you take the thermodynamic limit, undecidable.
Okay.
So, yep. But there you go. It's a tough problem. Okay. So what was their algorithm in this old 2009 paper? So we got some Hamiltonian that's without loss of generality a sum of projectors. And their algorithm was to run this process. So this is a quantum channel or completely positive trace preserving map. And if I unpack what this equation means, it says, okay, pick a random term in the Hamiltonian, measure it, perform the projective measurement corresponding to that term and its complement. If you get the, I always get the complements wrong here. This complement shouldn't be here because of the way I've written it. So, okay, if you get the outcome that, if you manage to project onto the local ground space, just carry on. If you project it onto the complement of the local ground space, just replace the state of the whole system with the maximally mixed state, for example. You can do other things in this step. Instead of throwing away the entire state, you can update the state locally, and they discuss various options in the paper. But that's like the simplest version of their algorithm is measure the local term, see if you've projected onto the local ground space. If you have, repeat. If you haven't, throw everything and start again and just run this over and over. Just keep iterating this over and over. So it's a very simple algorithm. And what they proved is that the fixed point of this map, so if you iterate this, the fixed point of this, it will inexorably converge to eventually, is the ground state of the many-body Hamiltonian.
Question?
Yeah.
Do you require the projector to commute with each?
Nope. Just frustration freeness. So that's a weaker assumption than commuting.
Could you give an example of a Hamiltonian that's frustration free but doesn't satisfy that?
Sorry, that doesn't satisfy
the commuting projector.
Stabilizer Hamiltonians would be the classic example. But there are. Oh, no, there's a commuting. Good point. Oh, God. Thank you. There are many body models as well.
AKLT Hunt.
If you MPS, then.
Great audience. Sorry, yeah, I always thought stabilizer because people, the usual question, I was answering the wrong question. That's the one that where the ground, they're commuting, but the ground state isn't product, which is what I, the wrong, right answer to the wrong question. Okay, so what they proved is that this converges. The fixed point of this dynamic, this map, if you iterate it, is the ground state, assuming the Hamiltonian is frustration free. So the nice thing about this algorithm compared to the other things I put in my table, which some of which are later than this work, were invented later, is a very simple local procedure. You just iteratively measure local terms in Hamiltonian. It doesn't matter what state you start with. I didn't say anything about the input state to this, and it doesn't matter. The output is the fixed point of this process. So whatever state you start with, you will end up in the right output. It also, they argue in the paper that it succeeds even if you're hit by errors during the computation. So you start with the wrong state, or halfway through, cosmic rays come in and scramble the quantum state. It'll keep on pushing it back to the fixed point to the correct ground state that you're looking for. So they argued in this paper that this was inherently had some resilience to errors during the computation. Disadvantages, it only works for frustration-free Hamiltonians. And as Graham pointedly asked, you can't tell, given a description of a Hamiltonian, if it's frustration-free or not. That problem is itself something that we expect to take exponential time, even on a quantum computer. The fact that the algorithm is exponential time is a disadvantage, but it's still, it's there's nothing you can do about it unless you collapse QMA to BQP. So that's in brackets there because we have to live with that for this problem and hope that when we actually run an algorithm on some particular problem, it doesn't, we don't hit the bad cases, the QMA hard cases.
Question?
Yep.
In the third point in the advantages,
yeah.
You say it succeeds even if it is hit by errors, but only proven for error rate zero.
That's right. So if I have I will come back to this later in more detail, this argument is just it's not a proof in their paper, it's an argument. It's true if at some point once during the computation it gets hit by errors and then you carry on running correctly. But if every step of the algorithm you have some error rate, their arguments don't go through and prove that it's robust. I have proven that now, so now I do know that it is, but this is in the paper that I'm discussing, and I'll come back to that. So, good question. That's why that caveat's there. They only proved it for this in that original paper. Okay, so what I'm going to talk about in this talk is a new algorithm, which I call DQE, for marketing reasons. And in some sense, it retains all of the benefits of the dissipative state engineering algorithm of Fischrata, Wolf, and Sirac, but it overcomes the limitations. And in particular, it works for arbitrary Hamiltonians, not just frustration-free Hamiltonians. And top of that, it is resilient to noise in a way I'll make precise later, in a stronger sense, and I can actually prove that rigorously. That proof actually does also apply to the dissipative state engineering. It wasn't known before, but it's now proven. So it has some disadvantages. It's not, you know, a panacea. Firstly, it's exponential time. Nothing you can do about that. Also, there are some things which I maybe will mention at the end where there's some things that are disadvantages compared to other algorithms. But overall, it does pretty well on my artificially selected table of metrics for algorithms that are biased in order to make my work look good.
The one that you have that you don't do looks weird. What
yeah.
do you mean?
I will get there. You'll see. I think it'll be clear once I've described what the algorithm is, actually. Ask me again if I haven't answered the question in a few slides. So benefit, what's the difference between the dissipative state engineering? So the difference is it's still a simple local procedure where you just measure local something related, local operators and iterate. It works for any Hamiltonian now, but this is the key difference. It's no longer just a frustration tree, but an arbitrary Hamiltonian. We don't have to assume anything about the Hamiltonian or know any of its properties. Just give me the description, I can construct the algorithm, and it's guaranteed provably to converge to the ground state. And it's fault resilience, in a way I will make precise. And there's no overhead here. There's no error correcting codes. There's no fault tolerant circuit implementations. The whole algorithm requires one qubit more than is needed to hold the entire ground state. So the overhead is one ancilla, and yet you get some form of resilience to noise that's like a weak version of fault tolerance just built in. Disadvantage, it's still exponential time. I can't do anything about that without winning a Turing Award, because I'd have to prove QMA is in BQP, and I'm not smart enough. Okay, so what's the difference? On a high level, there are two new ingredients. So one, the algorithm doesn't use projective measurements, it uses weak measurements. In other words, generalized measurements where one of the element of the POVM is close to the identity matrix. And it's not a fixed point algorithm. It makes use of information coming out of the measurement outcomes instead of just blindly measuring, resampling, and then carrying on without conditioning anything on the information you've gained from the measurements. So on a very high level, these are the two things that allowed me to overcome this limitation to frustration-free Hamiltonians. So to get into the, to start going into the technical detail of that, I need to divert briefly to something, to AGSP, so approximate ground state projectors. I'm really gonna do little more than put up the definition and one construction. So this concept of AGSPs was, I think it wasn't even introduced first in this paper, but this definition, this generalizes a definition that appeared in this paper by Dorit, Aharonov, et al. From 2013, where they reproved the 1D area law. So I will define an approximate ground state projector to be any Hermitian operator K. I say it's a delta gamma epsilon AGSP for some projector pi zero if there's some it's acting on pi. When I act with this operator on pi, it doesn't contract that projector too much. So think of gamma, if I've got a good AGSP, gamma is close to one, delta is close to zero. So it doesn't shrink the ground state subspace too much. The complement of the ground state subspace gets shrunk a lot. And it's not really the ground state subspace, it's just a subspace that's close to the ground state subspace. So this pi is some projector that's close to the ground state projector, but not exactly the same thing, it's epsilon away. Okay? And this projector pi should commute with k. So that's the definition of AGSP. So you can think that if I had a 0, 1, 0 AGSP, that would be the ground, have to be the ground state projector itself. If I have something that's a small delta, big gamma, small epsilon, I've got a good approximation to the ground state projector, but not perfect. So this slightly generalizes the definition, and here they have gamma always equal to 1.
But the condition where k commutes with pi is unusual, right? I mean that.
But this is, pi is not the ground state projector. This
no,
is
I
just,
know, but,
yeah.
It assume, I mean, still it seems unusual. Maybe, like, are there constructions with this property, or?
I think in the original AGSP constructions, this always holds.
Yeah, in the original, right?
In the original, I think k commutes with pi naught itself.
Oh, because
it's diagonal in the same eigenbasis. So this is generalizing that a little bit by you have to have something close by that it commutes with, but doesn't have to exactly commute anymore. So it's relaxing that a bit.
Yeah. What is pi again?
It's some projector that's close to the ground state projector, epsilon close. So this is 0.4. Okay, and this lemma just says that you can construct approximate ground state projectors out of the Hamiltonian in a way that can be is locally implementable. So let's unpack this math. Ki is just some rescaled, renormalized version of the local term in the Hamiltonian. Kappa here is just normalization. Kappa sub I is normalization of the interaction strengths. Can sort of ignore that. And what one can show is that if I construct this thing, which this operator is not a very good AGSP actually, but it's at least it's got some parameters, gamma, delta, and epsilon. So it's an AGSP with not particularly great parameters, but it's not trivial. So gamma is pretty big, but if you make epsilon small, then gamma is big, but delta is also quite big. But there is a gap between them. So gamma is bigger than delta, so it's not trivial. Why do I care about this AGSP? You know, there are better ones out there, but this one can be implemented by local measurements. So if I just simplify the notation here by calling this whole thing capital K sub I, so rewrite it like that, then what does this correspond to physically? It says weak measure each local term and the Hamiltonian in turn. So just do terms 1 through m, and then I'm going to do terms m down to 1 in the opposite order because I want this to be Hermitian, because it makes life more convenient, basically.
Question?
Yeah.
So in this algorithm, besides getting k, can you get a pi directly?
Sorry?
Can you get pi directly?
From k?
Yeah.
If you could directly solve the eigen, get the, you know, you could take construct k on a classical computer and solve the eigenvector problem for k, yes, just like for the Hamiltonian. But it's an exponentially big matrix, so that will take exponential time. Yeah. So this can be implemented probabilistically. We weak measure each of these local terms in turn, in order, and if we will have implemented k, the AGSP k, if we obtain the all good outcomes. So I'm going to label the good outcome by 0 because we're trying to go to the ground state to low energy, and 1 is the bad outcome in my labeling here. So each local measurement term, this is the, I will label this the 0 outcome. It's a binary outcome measurement, generalized measurement. And we will implement k if we measure each local term and get the good outcome. Okay. So I can, if I look just quickly at what the circuit looks like to implement this, this is to implement 1 term of this, it's actually not so bad. So all we need to do, if we've got a Hamiltonian that's a sum of Pauli terms, Pauli strings, which is kind of without lots of generality because we can always make any Hamiltonian look like that. And if we're doing it on a real quantum computer, we have to, because real quantum computers typically have qubits available, not qubits. Okay, so if we do that, the circuit looks like just do a bunch of basis change, single qubit basis change, the ones that, you know, the Hadamard or the corresponding operator for X, Y, and Z. Then do a bunch of control knots to some ancilla and then undo them all. And then the weak measurement comes from doing a rotation here where these angles phi and theta are small, or one, or theta is close to 1 rather. Close to 0. Okay, so this circuit is not too bad. It involves 1 ancilla and it involves a bunch of Clifford operations. The only non-Clifford operation here are these single qubit rotations on this ancilla. Okay, so that's all I want to say about approximate ground state projectors. There's plenty more to say, but I'm going to not say any more about it and go on to how can we construct out of these AGSPs an algorithm that is guaranteed to give the ground state. So this will take a few steps. Firstly, I'm going to define a quantum instrument, E0, E1. So what is, if you haven't heard of quantum instruments or have forgotten, they don't crop up so often, but it's a convenient way of describing this algorithm. This is 2 completely positive maps, but not trace preserving, but they sum up to something trace preserving. So this is the most general possible dynamics in quantum mechanics, so that it actually unifies both measurement and dynamics into one structure. So this is something that I can implement in quantum mechanics, and these are completely positive maps that sum to something trace preserving. So one element of this instrument is just implement my AGSP. And the other is the map I need to add to this to make it a fully trace preserving map. So this says I get all the good outcomes in my AGSP measurements. And then this gives me the post-measurement state. This says I get a bad outcome in my AGSP measurement with this probability 1 minus trace that I got the right outcome. And then when that happens, I'm just going to throw everything away and replace it with a maximally mixed state. Okay. So this is a bit of a dumb thing to do. There are better things you can do here, but I'm starting with the simplest version. Okay, now we just iterate this. Start from the maximally mixed state and keep iterating this algorithm, this map, this instrument. So implement this AGSP and do it again and do it again. But remember the outcomes you got in each. So this is the 0 outcome. I successfully measured applied the AGSP. This is the failure outcome. And I just carry on doing this until I get a string of n good outcomes. And that I'll denote the state that I get conditioned on getting n zeros as rho sub n. And now what I claim is that rho sub n is close to has high overlap with the ground state subspace. And you can bound the overlap with the ground state subspace of the output state here by this quantity. So capital D here is the total Hilbert space dimension. So this is, if you've got n, little n, I'm using little n for something else. If I've got q qubits, then this dimension is 2 to the q. So this is exponential in the number of qubits in the size of my system. Capital N is just the ground state degeneracy. Okay, so that's what this formula is. And this delta and gamma are the parameters of my AJSP. So remember that delta is smaller than gamma, so this is smaller than 1, so this term is decreasing exponentially with R. But we have an exponentially large prefactor in front of it. Okay.
Well, is the Rossov n that you would get in that case something like the nth power of...
Yeah, it's just that. Yeah, that's it. So let's prove this theorem, and that's the first... That's the second line of this proof. So remember that our AJSP, we have some projector that's close to the ground state projector that commutes with K. So now it's not difficult to show that K to the power of n applied to rho, and if I take the trace against pi of this, you're just using commutative, the fact that it commutes, I can rewrite that and use the definition of the AJSP to bound it by gamma to the n times this trace. So I'm going to go through it in detail, but that's a simple exercise. And similarly, a bound when I trace against the complement of pi of the same object. So this just follows from commutativity with pi and the definition of the AJSP of gamma and delta in the AJSP. So with those relations in mind, rho is just what Graham just said. So it's the nth power of k applied to rho and then renormalize. So that's the state rho sub n. And then the trace of the ground state against this, well, I just plug it in, rewrite it a bit by taking this as, you know, expanding this at the bottom as a term in terms of pi plus pi complement, splitting that apart, rearranging a bit, and then just bounding using the bounds, the inequalities I just put on this previous slide, plug those in, and I get this expression here. So it's straightforward algebra. And then simplify a bit. And now I just plug in the final step. Well, then I'm going to plug in my initial state here. I've left it arbitrary at the moment. So, but actually, I said that we're going to start with a maximally mixed state. So let's plug that in. That means trace of pi against maximally mixed state now is just n over d. So I can plug that in the formula, and that simplifies further. And now the last thing is that I want not the trace of the output state against pi, but I want it against pi sub zero. But pi is an epsilon close to pi sub zero, so I just get an extra error, additive error term of epsilon. And so the overall result then is this, epsilon worse than this. Okay, so it's just not a difficult proof. It's just relatively straightforward, just algebra and manipulate stuff and use the definition of AJSPs. Good, so we have something that gets close to the ground state subspace when it stops and guaranteed to be. However, we're not there yet. So there's our process. One interesting question is, how long does this take to stop? Turns out, actually, for this process, we can actually get an exact analytic expression for the expected stopping time of this. So it's going to be exponential, but we can actually get an exact expression for it, not just kind of an asymptotic scaling. So it looks like this, and because it's a very cute proof, I think I've got time to actually go through it. And this is the last thing I'll kind of prove even sketch the proof of in this talk, but let's do this. So imagine you're a betting man, like Graham, and Graham is gonna bet on the sequence of zero out and one outcomes of my algorithm. And he's going to bet according to the following strategy. At time step t, he'll bet everything he's won so far. Because, you know, it's Graham. Graham is a risk taker. So at time t, he's just going to bet everything he's won so far. He's going to put his entire stakes on, and an additional t pounds, because I'm British, on the zero outcome coming up next, on the good outcome. But, you know, I'm a fair person, so I'm going to give him fair odds on this process. I'm not going to be gaming it like a casino so that I win. It's actually going to be a fair game. So if the outcome zero does come up next, Graham gets back all of his stake times the odds. So he gets more than his, gets back his stake times the odds, so that it's a fair game. And if the outcome's one, he loses everything. But he can carry on claiming because Graham is also infinitely wealthy, so he just keeps on putting more of his own money into it. He just plays the next round with £2, further £2. He's keeping on bleeding money if he gets the one outcome, but there you go. Okay.
Is there something about how you eventually run out of money if you try to do this?
Yeah, but I mean, Graham is, you know, very, very well known to be infinitely rich, right? So, this is just a
crap.
this is just a process we can construct to analyze the mass of this. So yes, this is indeed related to the fact that you have to be infinitely rich to not lose all your money on this game. Exactly. We'll get to that. In fact, this slide will that it relates to that math a bit. Okay, so let's define some random variables. I'm going to label x sub t be the tth outcome, so it's 0, 1, according to whether I successfully measured the AGSP or I failed to. And I'm going to denote m sub t, my net winnings at time t, so how much money I've got, or Graham's got, won. How much money he's won in total. So he's put some of his own money in, but how much has he got minus how much he's put in at time step t. So these are two random variables. Clearly, at the beginning, before he starts playing the game, his net winnings are zero because he hasn't played yet. And at m sub t, well, just from the definition of the game, this is what the net winnings are, right? So he's staked everything he'd won at the previous round plus an extra t pounds, and then times one over the odds because it's a fair game. That's the return. That's what we'll have if the zero outcome comes up. And if the one outcome comes up, well, he's lost everything. And whatever he's won and lost up till then, overall, what he's done is had to put in t. He's lost t pounds because that's how much he put in to play the last round. Okay. Now, what's the expectation of the total winnings given a sequence of outcomes up to, you know, the t minus one outcome? What's the expected value of the total winnings at the next time step? Well, that's the probability that zero comes up times what the return is, minus the probability that one comes up times what, you know, the amount you've lost. That's just from the definition of my betting strategy. And if you just do a little bit of algebra, look, this cancels with this denominator, this cancels with something or other. So this t will cancel with that, and then I've got probability of 0 plus probability of 1 times something, and all of this ends up, if you just do the algebra, this just ends up equal to m sub t minus 1. In other words, this m sub t, this stochastic process m sub t, is a martingale with respect to the outcomes of the algorithm. This is just the definition of a martingale, so that the expectation value of the random variable, given everything that came before, is just equal to the value of the random variable at the previous time step. So that's the definition of a martingale process in probability theory. And the martingale process is just can always be viewed as a fair betting game. Okay, so you don't want to play a martingale because, as you say, you only come out even if you have infinite wealth and can carry on. The fluctuations can grow arbitrarily large, but at least in the long run, if you're infinite wealthy, a martingale is a fair game. You expect to come out with as much as you put in. Okay, why is that useful? There's a theorem in martingale theory called Dube's optional stopping theorem that says that if you conditionally stop a martingale process, so conditionally stopping just means I look at everything that's happened so far and there's some decision process that only looks at the outcomes I've had up to that point in time, not the future ones, and decides whether to stop or not. So something that you can actually implement in reality. It's not clairvoyant, it can't look into the future. Any process that decides whether to stop at this step and say that's the end, just based on the past, is called a stopping rule or stopping condition. And any stopped martingale process is also a martingale. This is the content of Dube's optional stopping theorem. So this says that the expected value of m sub tau at the stopping time, sorry, I should say the m sub tau n, so the process that stops, the conditionally stopped process is also a martingale. And since the expected outcome at the stopping time is just, this is a martingale. Since this is a martingale, this means that I expect to come out of this process, even if I have some clever strategy to choose when to walk away from the table, because it's a martingale, in expectation, I will just walk away with whatever I started with, which is zero. So it's a fair game. It doesn't matter what betting strategy or what strategy you have to walk away from the casino, you will just walk away with whatever you started with. In a fair game, in a real casino, you'll walk away having lost money, because it's not a fair game. But this one's a fair game. Okay, but we know what this is. The expectation value at the beginning of your net winnings at the beginning was zero because the game started with, you didn't start with anything as your net winnings. Okay, now remember in our algorithm, every time we get a one outcome, we reset to the maximally mixed state. So after we've had a run of k zeros, the state is just, well, we've had a run of k zeros, the step before that k run of k zeros must have been a 1, so we must have had the maximally mixed state at that point. And then we got k zeros, so we just applied our AGSP k times. Renormalize. That's just this. The probability that we get a 0 on the next step is just the probability of successfully measuring the AGSP on that state, which is just this expression. OK. But when we've just had a run of n zeros, I switched to n instead of k, sorry. Well, we've just had a run of n zeros since the last one. The last one, we lost everything and ended up with net winnings of however many steps we've played. So our net winnings, n steps before the run of k zeros, which is when we last had a 1, was just from the definition of our game, is just minus the time, the value of the time step, which is minus tau sub n minus n, in other words, minus tau sub n plus n. So that's just from the betting, the definition of the betting strategy, straightforwardly. Similarly, we can work out what is the net winnings k steps before we got that run of n zeros. So rewind k steps from our stopping time. And from the definition of our betting strategy, we can just write down the value of the net winnings at that point. And we know that we already worked out on the previous slide an expression for the probability of zero getting the next zero, given that we just got a run of k zeros. We worked it out to be this simple kind of expression, ratio of two traces. And this whole thing, this now defines a recurrence relation on M, which I can solve, and I'm not going to do that explicitly on the slides, but this defines a recurrence relation for M, which I can then solve for without too much difficulty and get a solution for the M sub tau sub N from solving this recurrence relation. Okay, great. Why did I care about this being a fair betting process and proving that this was a martingale? Well, I'm now going to just take expectations of everything. Okay. These quantities, the values of the random variables are equal, so their expectations are equal on both sides. And now, well, this thing on the right hand, this thing in brackets here, this is just there's no random variable here. This is just a deterministic quantity. It's just fixed. So the expectation of this is just the value of it. So I can take away the expectation there. This we proved is 0 on the right-hand side. The expected winnings at the stopping time, you expect to walk away no better off than you started. And now I can just rearrange, and that gives me the expected running stopping time of my algorithm is just given by pulling this over the other side. So it seems a bit like magic when you first see it, this martingale proof approach. You define some betting game that seems to come from nowhere that's a fair game, and then you just manipulate this using the fact that it's a fair betting game to suddenly magically get an expression for the expected time at which you stop. So it's a really nice technique in probability theory it's well known. And martingale methods are well known, but not applied so often to quantum processes. Okay, if you didn't follow that, it doesn't matter, but it's a really cute proof technique to know. I can bound this quantity by the properties of the AGSP just from the definition of AGSP to get an expression in terms of its parameters. We can just sanity check this. If my AGSP is actually the ground state projector exactly, then delta would be 0, gamma would be 1, so all of this disappears. And what I end up with is something that has the interpretation of what am I doing? When I apply my AGSP, I would just be projecting exactly onto the ground state, which happens with probability n over d, right? The ground state subspace divided by the total dimension divided by the total Hilbert space dimension. And then once I've successfully projected on the ground state subspace, which takes n over d tries, because I'm starting with a uniformly random state, the maximally mixed state. After that, once I've done that, I have to have a further n minus 1 steps where I measure again to get a run of n zeros. But each of those, I'm in the ground state, and now it will deterministically succeed. So if I put in the special case of actually having an exact AGSP, this sanity checks that it gives the right expression. OK, here's what the algorithm looks like if you simulate it, implement a simulation of it, and run it. The ground state, the energy of the state at the current step. Of course, we can't measure this in a quantum algorithm without easily, but in a classical simulation of it, we can just evaluate the energy as the algorithm goes along. You know, it wiggles about. Every time it has a run of zeros, it kind of goes down, tends to go down. Then you get a bad outcome, and it jumps up again. And eventually, you get a good run of zeros. The ground state energy plummets down to something close to the true ground state energy, which is this blue dotted dashed line here. And then the algorithm halts because it's got a run of n zeros. So that's kind of what it looks like when you run it.
So, Toby, yeah. A million a million time step?
Yeah. This is not the best version of the algorithm.
I mean, the Hilbert space dimension here is 1,000.
Yeah.
So why is it not like 1,000?
Let's actually a product of two exponentials in my runtime. But this is also a stupid version of the algorithm. You can do better than this. This is just where every time I get a bad outcome, I throw everything away and start again, which is not a clever thing to do. There are better things. Might get onto that. That's in the bonus section. Okay, we're not there yet. So, okay, we've got a conditionally stopped process. We've proven that independent of what the Hamiltonian is, will eventually produce the ground state, maybe very slowly.
Yeah. Because you said there was a smart way to do things, but didn't you say that, isn't the stopping time, well,
it has to be exponential.
A martingale suggesting there's no smart thing to do?
There's a better update thing to do, which is no longer a martingale. So a smarter thing to do, and this is what you do in classical local search algorithms for SAT problems, you don't, whenever you kind of have your current assignment, you have a clause that's not verified, you don't throw everything away and guess a new bit string. What you do is you locally resample. So you can, it's mathematically less easy to prove results about, but if I get to here, in the bonus section, you can do this, and now instead of throw away the whole state when you get the bad outcome, you've just done a local measurement that's failed. Now just resample those qubits, not all of them, and this converges faster. And it's still an exponential time algorithm, but the exponent is smaller. But it's harder to analyze mathematically and prove things about, so I'm starting with a simple version, which is not it's not what you would implement in reality. It's a dumb version of the algorithm. So I'll say a little bit more and show you simulations if I get there. But I'm not quite done yet, because, sorry, was there a question about that?
Yeah, just, I think I missed it when you explained it, but why is the actual distributive protocol a fair game?
I just defined my game in a way that made sure that it was just set up so that it was fair. So I defined what the rules are of how much you won and lost in each outcome, and I just set it so that it was a fair game. So okay. That came from the fact that
the probability of seeing a certain outcome, no? Like,
no, it's related to, I just made the odds of the game fair, that's all. Okay. And that's something I put in, I just chose, because this martingale game is not part of the algorithm, it's part of the analysis.
Okay.
So I just chose that martingale deliberately, the winning, the odds of the game. So when you bet, you don't get back, it's not 50-50. If you bet on the zero outcome and you win, you get back something that's proportional to the one over the probability that you would have won. So it's a fair, I deliberately set it up to be a fair game, because that's how you make this martingale analysis trick, this martingale proof technique work. Yeah. It's nothing, that has nothing to do with the algorithm itself. That's to do with the analysis of the algorithm. Okay, I think I am just about out of time. I am gonna just about get through the main content and we'll see how much further. So I've proven this, but the problem is, I claimed that my algorithm worked independent of without needing to know anything about the Hamiltonian, independent of its properties. But I haven't actually proven that yet, because gamma and delta, the parameters of my AGSP, are related to the ground state energy and first excited state energy of my Hamiltonian. And the problem is, I don't know what those are, but I need gamma to be strictly bigger than delta for this term to be strictly smaller than one, and therefore decreasing. But the problem is, I don't know what to set epsilon to make sure that gamma is bigger than delta, unless I know the spectral gap of my Hamiltonian. So I've cheated on you. I've hidden the knowledge of the spectrum of the Hamiltonian in delta and gamma at the moment. And of course, finding the spectrum of a Hamiltonian is at least as hard as finding its ground state energy. It's QMA hard, actually worse. And so this algorithm, I can't actually, it takes me exponential time to even figure out what my algorithm parameters should be. So I have to rectify this, which is what I just said. So how do we rectify this? The solution to this is to choose the parameter epsilon in my AGSP not to be a constant, but to be decreasing with time. Okay. So epsilon was just some parameter, a free parameter in my local AGSP implementation. It's how weak are my weak measurements. I can choose that. But instead of choosing it based on the knowledge of the spectrum of the Hamiltonian, which I don't have, what I need to do is to choose it as a decreasing sequence as I run the algorithm. So okay, I can prove, and I'm not going to go through this proof in detail, is if you take our process, same instrument, stop after n zeros, but now epsilon I take as decreasing with 1 over t. where, or more precisely, I take it as decreasing in the as one over the time since the last failure outcome, so the last time I got a one. As I get zeros, I keep on decreasing epsilon. If I get an outcome one, I reset back to epsilon the zero, the starting epsilon, and then I decrease again. Okay, if rho n is the stopping state now of this process with decreasing epsilon, I can prove that the limit, this converges in the limit of n going to infinity, this converges to exactly to the ground state. Okay, and I can even get a bound on what that convergence looks like, but I'm not gonna put it because it's a bit of a mess. So I'm gonna give very, very vague intuition of how this proof goes. Once epsilon is smaller than the spectral gap, my algorithm is gonna work and start driving to the ground state. But until epsilon is smaller than the gap, it's just might be doing driving the state in the wrong direction. Once epsilon is small enough, the convergence goes as something like each step contracts towards the ground state subspace by a factor of one minus one order one over t. Okay. This is a product of one minus one over t, product over t. So this is a product over something that's a divergent series, which implies that the infinite product is a convergent product and converges to zero. It's an elementary first year undergraduate analysis. On the other hand, the error accumulated up to the point where the algorithm starts actually working, the error accumulated goes as a sum over something that's going as 1 over t squared, because my AGSP is order epsilon squared precise. And you won't remember, but from the slide where I wrote down the AGSP and the parameters of it, it's a gamma delta order epsilon squared AGSP, where epsilon is my weak measurement parameter. So essentially, there's a delicate trade-off between the rate at which I kind of accumulate errors up to the point where the algorithm starts working and the rate of contraction towards the ground state subspace once I do start have an epsilon that's smaller than the threshold. And the balance between these two is a slightly delicate analysis, but this kind of wins out over this, because this goes as kind of 1 over t and this goes as 1 over t squared. That's all I'm going to say about the proof of this, and for details, look at the paper. Okay, but take home message is that with this, if you take this deep, carefully chosen decreasing sequence of values of epsilon, now I have an algorithm that is guaranteed to converge to the ground state. It doesn't require any knowledge of Hamiltonian. It will work for any Hamiltonian. You just have to give me the description of a Hamiltonian, and we can give you a process that will eventually converge to its ground state. Good. I think I will spend the last minutes I've got left are enough to talk about false resilience. And this is kind of, in some sense, the main motivation for the original dissipative state engineering algorithm and the motivation for this work, and why Phasecraft is paying me to do it at all, is because the big problem in current quantum computers is errors and noise, but we don't have enough qubits and gates to do fault tolerance. And I don't think that's going to happen for a long time yet. So we're really interested in Phasecraft and algorithms that work even when the quantum computer is very noisy, but don't need a million physical qubits per logical qubit to actually do a fault tolerant circuit, because we can't do that yet. We'd have to wait too long. So the motivation of the dissipative state engineering, there were some arguments, but not a proof of any kind of real fault resilience. The argument was that this dissipative process should be inherently robust to noise, because it's driving things back to a ground state, or the right output state, because it's a dissipative process. So in some sense, hand-waving physics terms, it's a process that is extracting entropy from the system, where the unitary process isn't, preserves entropy, and entropy will just build unless you do something to get it out of that. That intuition is not very good, but it's some kind of intuition for why dissipative processes might be more resilient to noise. Okay, let's actually make that precise. So what if errors occur during the process? What if instead the process itself, I'm implementing these measurements on local measurements by a circuit on a near-term quantum computer, and near-term quantum computers don't do the right thing when you ask them to. They get it slightly wrong. This is error fault. This is why we need fault tolerance, not just error correction. So the process itself, I don't necessarily have access to ideal operations, just like in standard fault tolerance setting in quantum computation. So both of these possibilities, since I'm describing my process in terms of quantum instrument, I can actually conveniently fold this all into the instrument. So what this amounts to mathematically is that instead of doing the perfect process described by these maps E sub 0 and E sub 1, I'm doing an imperfect process that has some external noise and is faulty and actually implements a process described by a different instrument e prime sub 0 and e prime sub 1, where these are delta close to the correct one, where delta is kind of my fault rate. So at each time step, I do something that's close but delta away from the correct thing. And that encompasses both doing the wrong thing. This doesn't mean the errors are the same in every step. It just means the errors are IID, okay? Or the faults are IID, that's all. What I can prove is that if I've got the setup, so I implement something that's delta away from the correct algorithm, if I iterate the same this faulty process and I stop when I get a run of n zeros again, then and rho sub n now again denotes the stopping state of this process, but now it's the faulty process, then in the limit, I don't converge to the ground state exactly anymore, but I converge to something that's only order delta and epsilon away from it. So the key thing here is that although my error, my algorithm is faulty, and I'm not doing any active error correction or fault tolerance, I am only delta away from the correct output, independent of the runtime of this algorithm. If I just did this with a unitary dynamics, I would be order delta times the runtime away, which grows over time, and I would just get something that's arbitrarily far from the ground state subspace. Whereas with this dissipative algorithm, this is not full fault tolerance. So full fault tolerance would say that as long as I'm below threshold, I can implement a process that will get close to the correct output, independent of the runtime and independent of the noise rate, as long as the noise rate's below threshold. I have something a bit weaker here, which is why I'm calling it fault resilience and not fault tolerance. I can get close to the correct output, independent of the runtime, but how close I am does depend on the noise rate, even when I'm below threshold. So it's weaker than fault resilience, but on the other hand, I have no overhead, no error correcting codes, no fault tolerance circuits. I just have one ancilla.
Can you remind what epsilon is again?
Epsilon is just the parameter in my AGSP, so think of it as very small, and I can choose it freely. It just, the runtime goes up if I make it small. Okay, proof. This is now not even a sketch or an intuition, it's just a hint, but the proof goes by looking at, like, when I iterate a map, if I write it in its as a transfer matrix, this is equivalent to taking the power of the transfer matrix. And then there's a whole bunch of nice maths. Non-commutative Perron-Frobenius theory, that's about Markov processes, but generalized the quantum, and then the Schur structure of this matrix and some eigenspace perturbation theory. So the proof is in the paper, and those are kind of the ingredients, and that's all I'm going to say, I think, about proof. That's all I have time to say. But I can show you some plots from simulations. So this is a plot where I've simulated a small Heisenberg chain, noise rate picked something, 10 to the minus 4. But the important thing is the difference is these three curves. So the purple dots are just the ground state, the energy. So the dashed line is the true ground state energy of the system. The purple is the energy of the output state when I take the runtime to be as a function of the runtime of the algorithm. And you can see that independent of the runtime, the output, the state is staying close to the ground state. The output state is staying close to the ground state. The green curve is what happens if I take exactly the same noise process. I start with the ground state itself and I just let it do the noise accumulate. So this is what you would get for unitary dynamics. And yet the dissipative process you can see is stabilizing the state close to the ground state in the output, even though there's the same noise process running. So this is just numerically the fault resilience in action. You can see it in action in the simulations.
Can you tell us how long it takes to get there?
Yes. Let's scroll ahead. So far we did a stupid thing, right? Every time we got the bad outcome, we threw away everything. There's a smarter thing you can do, which is to resample the qubits you just measured low, because you only measured a k qubits or k qubits and got the wrong outcome on those k. Instead of throwing away the whole state, let's just replace, let's say, with a maximally mixed state locally. If you do that process, what I call local resampling, we can still get analytic expressions for the expected state and the expected runtime, but they're much harder mathematically to get at. The expressions are now in terms of big exponentially large matrices, so we can compute numerically these quantities, but we can't now actually give a nice analytic closed form scaling. But we can compute rather than simulate the runtime and how successful it is under the smarter resampling strategy. And here's what happens numerically. So purple is the global resampling strategy. You can see runtime is going exponentially. This is now in the size of the system. So this is Heisenberg chain, 1D Heisenberg chain up to size 8. The limit of how far I go is just to do with even on decent GPUs, you can't go much further than that. Because we're simulating density matrices here, and that means my matrices, I pick up a square in the size of the matrix. Actually, worse than that, because I'm computing things on the transfer matrix of a CP map, so actually the size of the matrices goes as Hilbert space dimension to the power of 4, and that's why I can only get up to about 8 instead of something like 30. Okay, but nonetheless, you can see fairly clearly that the local resampling, which is the green, is still growing exponentially, but with an exponent that's smaller. And the runtimes look pretty big. You know, we're still talking on a Heisenberg chain of length 8, which I can pretty straightforwardly, directly solve fully on a classical computer, on a GPU. We're still talking runtimes of like getting onto a million or 10 million steps. However, this is slightly, just talking about runtime when you're in a dissipative algorithm is slightly misleading because it's not the same as circuit depth in a unitary algorithm because you don't have to maintain coherence for 10 million steps. In fact, this comes from stopping as soon as you get 4 zeros in a row, this plot, I believe. So this means that your circuit depth in terms of how long does your quantum computer have to keep the state alive for, with good precision, is now depth 4 for this algorithm. You have to repeat a lot of times, but you only have to keep the effective circuit depth is only 4 in this, or 4 times a little bit of overhead, because there's a circuit I put up before, so 4 times some small constant. So, and depending on how fast your quantum computer is, doing 10 million iterations on a superconducting device actually doesn't take very long. What matters is can you keep coherence for long enough for the output to be useful on current quantum computers. So it's slightly misleading to compare this with this runtime is not the same as in a unary circuit. Your quantum computer has to actually keep the information alive that long. This only has to keep coherence for depth 4, but you have to do a lot of iterations. Think, for example, low-depth VQE for an analogy, where you have to do lots and lots of iterations to optimize the VQE, but you only do a low-depth circuit in each run. It's similar to that.
Could you explain why the local resampling should work as well? Because it seems like if you get the wrong measurement outcome locally, that could affect, you know, some.
Good. Great. This is a good question. So why? What's the intuition of why this algorithm works? If you do the frustration-free version in the old paper, clearly for frustrated free Hamiltonians, slamming the thing into local ground space is good because the local ground space is also, you know, contains the global ground space. But if you do that for a frustrated Hamiltonian, the definition of frustration, if you unpack it, just means that the local ground space might be nowhere near the global ground space, and you've got, it's frustrated. So doing a projective measurement would be a bad news, and as you say, the wrong outcome locally might slam the whole state somewhere completely in the wrong part of Hilbert space, and that's why it doesn't work. But here we're only doing weak measurements. So if I get the wrong measurement outcome, that's the outcome that has only, you've only weakly perturbed the state. So you've gone in the wrong direction, but not too badly. And that's sort of one reason why intuitively the doing weak measurements means that you can, even though you're only doing local measurements and you're going in the wrong direction, it still overall nudges things towards the ground state, even when it's frustrated. Now, why doing local resampling is better? Because even when something is completely frustrated, it's still, this is now hand-waving physics intuition, but you don't necessarily have an infinite correlation length still. And so now the fact that you've messed up the state a bit over here doesn't necessarily mean that the state very far away is completely messed up. If I throw everything away, I'm throwing away all of the kind of, I've converged parts of the state to something that's in kind of the right region of Hilbert space. Locally. So that, I mean, that's very hand-waving intuition, but that intuition is borne out by classical algorithms that do the same thing. And again, local update algorithms are like, that's the basis for modern SAT solvers.
So is there like an optimal resampling range for like a given correlation length of
a... That's a great question, I don't know. The problem is that local resampling, I can't get as good an analytic handle on. And so it's harder to, you don't have to simulate to find out, you can compute. Can get analytic expressions that you then have to just do big matrix multiplication and take a trace to find out. But you have to do those big computations still to, and those computations take about a week or so for each instance on a GPU. So I don't have a good analytic handle on that kind of question. But I also haven't thought about it hard. I mean, there's a lot of interesting follow-up questions. Yeah. I think I'm out of time. So I might stop here and see if, in questions, you ask me stuff that will let me present the rest. And thanks a lot.
about grid talk? Any questions? Yeah.
There were a couple, so let's go.
Sorry, I have a sort of silly question just based on the two plots that you'd showed.
Yeah.
So in the very last plot that you showed us.
This one.
Where you're comparing the expected runtime against the number of qubits.
Mm-hmm.
And then earlier you had one where you had like a 10-qubit Heisenberg, 10-qubit chain,
yeah.
1D Heisenberg Hamiltonian, and you showed that that took about like a million time steps to get to state. And but then you said that that was also the not very efficient method of updates. But this seems like for a shorter chain, you're doing worse.
So firstly, this is with noise, remember? So we'd expect it to be a bit worse, whereas the other one was without noise.
Okay.
And secondly, the difference is like this is the comparable thing for this sim calculation for chain of length 8 with the doing the global resampling, and this is with doing local resampling. So it's doing much better.
Okay.
I've got a question about the Hamiltonian. So in your algorithm, you said the Hamiltonian, you need to know the classical description of the Hamiltonian.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if your algorithm or something similar could work if the Hamiltonian is given as a black box.
That's a good question. it's not a question we're interested in Phasecraft, because we actually want to implement algorithms, and no one ever gives me a Hamiltonian as a black box. My guess, without thinking deeply about it, is probably there's smarter things you can do if you have a black box implementation of the global Hamiltonian. If you just had black box a way of implementing the local terms of the Hamiltonian, I can probably turn that into the weak measurements and implement this. But if I have a black box that lets me do an AGSP for the global Hamiltonian, I will just call it a lot of times. I don't need to bother with any of this stuff. But that black box is way too powerful. If you mean a black box that implements time dynamics for that Hamiltonian,
yes.
That is the other algorithms, especially things like the imaginary time evolution and quite and pite algorithms, exactly use that. Of course, that's a block box that can be implemented by time dynamics imposition. Those algorithms work as well, but they involve a very complicated quantum circuit that's tantamount to doing, you know, time dynamic simulation, sometimes phase estimation. And if I had a large fault-tolerant quantum computer, I would probably run those algorithms or phase estimation or something like that. But that's the motivation of the whole discipline of engineering is to not do that. So you can use that, and there are lots of things in the literature that do.
Yes.
But the algorithms are much more complicated and probably need a fault-tolerant quantum computer to implement. And they're also exponential time because the ground state problem is exponentially hard, is worst case exponential as always.
Yeah.
They have to be. I'm not saying that like this is the algorithm to kill everything. The other algorithms are no longer interesting, but it has some big disadvantages doing it that way, which is that you can't implement it on a near-term quantum computer. You need fault tolerance. So,
right, thanks.
But yeah, that literature, you can look in my paper for citations. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of interesting literature on that recently.
I just want to make sure I understand.
Yeah.
You said at some point you only need to maintain coherence for sort of a fairly short amount of time. But isn't that just fairly short amount of time something that you showed is going to scale exponentially?
Ah, good. Yes. It would, yes, in worst case, that's right. And so it's sort of like you have an exponential number of tries, each one, and then an exponential depth to succeed. So it's an exponential times an exponential, which is still an exponential. So it's exponentials all the way down, theoretically and analytically. But in practice, the plot I put up before, which got very close to the ground state, was with stopping condition, get four zeros in a row, and that's all. So in practice, this is an exponential time algorithm, but the only hope is that in practice, on certain instances, you don't hit a bad case. And it seems from the numerics that I've done on Heisenberg and also on the Fermi-Hubbard model, that you can get, with very low numbers of zeros, you get much closer to the ground state than the theory bounds would suggest.
Does that suggest
but that's
reasonable methods of doing classical simulations of the states you're preparing?
Good question. I don't know. That's sort of equivalent to the question of if you can prepare the state with a low-depth quantum circuit, is there an efficient classical description that's useful? There is an efficient classical description, it's the low-depth circuit. but can you compute with that? That doesn't give you the quantum state. But that's sort of out of scope for this, because here the output is quantum, and a classical algorithm can't output a quantum state.
Can you make a statement like, if you have a low depth circuit, you're not going to have too much entanglement, maybe you won't have too much correlation?
You can try. Well, you can try and make those arguments, but I think you can't. I don't know of a proof that, I think that would be in tantamount to collapsing QCMA, QMA to QCMA or things like that. No? Gets into that territory. So I think in some cases, maybe, especially in cases where, like, I don't know, you've got area laws or things like that, but I don't know of a general theorem that says that. But yeah, it could be. And if you can get a better classical algorithm for many body problems, I'm very happy with that too, but no one has so far that works generically. And I think that would have complexity theory implications if you could prove that generally.
And would you say this is now the leading and best algorithm to be implemented on a NISQ device?
No. Well, for this problem. For this problem or in general?
For this problem.
For this problem. I don't know. It's really hard to get to solve the ground state problem on any computer, let alone a NISQ one, because, you know, it's QMA hard, and in practice is kind of hard. I think probably at the moment on near-term quantum computers, there are better things to do than this that are more heuristic. They don't have guarantees of that they will give the right output, but heuristically, they work quite well. I'm not necessarily talking about VQE here, but I think this is competitive with EQE. There's some benefits and disadvantages, but there are other things that are more heuristic that may work better if you want to solve, but they don't solve the same problem. They're not outputting a quantum state that you can then do something with. The answer is I don't know. We're running this on real hardware. At small scale, it works quite well, but this I wouldn't push this as a very practical algorithm at the moment, because this runtime is still kind of crazy, even if the circuit depth you have to go to is small. So, you know, this is sort of a side project for Spacecraft in terms of theory work. We're not selling this algorithm, but it might be the basic. But I think what I would say is that I think the biggest message I take from this, and I skipped my conclusions because I ran out of time, but I think there is hope that, I think this theory work kind of motivates the fact that, this I didn't mention, but this shows that, I think what I take from this for near-term quantum computation is that if you think carefully about how you design your algorithms, you can design the resilience to errors into the algorithm rather than just relying on doing a fault-tolerant construction that then you can pretend you have a perfect quantum computer. And I'm not sure the ground state problem is a good target for this, because we know it has to be worst-case exponential. But if you can build that kind of fault resilience into algorithms that are polytime and interesting on smaller instances that fit on near-term quantum computers, I think there are ways to try and avoid the issues of noise and errors that aren't full-scale fault tolerance. And this is a proof analytically with a lot of theorems that this, in one case, does work out. And that's, I think, the main message I take from NISQ, is that we should think how to deal with noise and errors that isn't just fault tolerance, because that's still a long way off. It's too resource intensive. And this is one approach of trying to think about how we can do this different, designing algorithms in a different way that are inherently resilient to errors rather than just relying on some magic person to implement fault tolerance someday, which, yeah, it's hard. Yeah.
But like you said, your algorithm start with a maximally mixed state, right?
Ah, good question.
How do you do that?
Oh, maximally mixed is easy. You just that's equivalent operationally. You just sample a random computational basis state, which is trivial. Just start with a random bit string or random state product state on your quantum computer in the computational basis. So that's mathematically the same as starting from the maximally mixed. That's easy. I thought you were going to ask a different question, which is starting from the maximally mixed state is a bit stupid. A lot of things about what I presented are like the simplest version of the algorithm to explain in a talk and to then analyze and prove theorems about. But then if you go to the paper, there's more. And if you were to run this in practice, you would firstly use the smart resampling methods that I can't get as nice theorems about, but in practice seem converge faster, but I can't prove it. And also you wouldn't start from the maximally mixed state. That's often you've got some idea of where the ground state is. You don't have to, you can start from a state that's lower in energy than just no knowledge. So for example, you could run VQE first, which might not give you, VQE is heuristic. You don't know if it's not guaranteed to give the right output. This algorithm is, it's a big advantage. On the other hand, this algorithm is very, in practice, slow compared to VQE in practice. Unless it works less, it's guaranteed to succeed eventually, but VQE in practice often works better in lower depth and runs in practice. So if you start with a VQE state, which might be in the right sort of ballpark, but not yet guaranteed, and now use this algorithm to do a kind of fine-tuning of that state to push it even lower, that's the kind of thing and that we're exploring. And so, yeah, starting from max and mixed state is also a dumb thing to do, and there's better things you can do when you actually run this. But I can't prove theorems about it. So this was a theory talk and theory work.
So when you use this epsilon schedule, does that change the running time at all?
The funny thing about exponential time algorithms is that when you're doing theory work, which is what I'm doing here, multiplying the whole thing by another exponential factor just means you've just got another exponential factor in your exponential runtime, and an exponential times an exponential times an exponential is still an exponential time algorithm. So yeah, adds another exponential time factor on the front, potentially. In the theory, upper bounds. That's not the same thing as what in practice. And with any algorithm, like an exponential time algorithm is only interesting on the instances where you don't hit the worst case bounds. But I'm doing worst case bounds.
What does the exponential depend on that you add?
In practice, it works pretty well. Just pick epsilon small enough. It doesn't have to be small in the spectral gap. It still works. Can't prove it. But numerically, you just choose a sufficiently small epsilon and run. And or decrease it gently over time, but not too hard. But actually, just picking it some small constant in practice works pretty well. But theoretically, provably, it doesn't always succeed.
In the classical setting, Schrödinger's algorithms and stuff, they use a mixture of local resampling and global resampling. You try some local resampling, and then if after a while you haven't found it, you've got to do a global resample to avoid some sort of minima.
That's right.
Of course, it's even much harder yet to analyze than local, just pure local resampling. If you start to look empirically, if alternating between local and global resampling gives you any sort of advantage.
Oh, alternating. Okay. Because Schrödinger kind of has local updates, but then you restart if you have run too long. Interesting idea. I don't know. In practice, from what I've seen from the numerics, local resampling just works much better than global resampling, and I would do that. I don't know if there's any benefit to occasionally. It's not the intuition of why this works is Schrödinger's algorithm is sort of a vague inspiration for this approach. Because Schrödinger's algorithm is also not a fixed point algorithm, and that's kind of the key to Schrödinger algorithm's success. And again, this doesn't run a Markov process to convergence, it runs a Markov process to a stopping time. But there, the similarity to Schrödinger and the intuition doesn't carry over. And I think the reason this is working is not the same as the intuition why Schrödinger works without running to convergence. So my expectation would be that occasionally doing global resampling, this algorithm does not seem to kind of get stuck with the local resampling. And do a big kind of reset to kind of get out of that minimum very hand wavingly. But I don't know, I haven't, it's a try it numerically. It's an interesting idea.
So you said there are a lot of methods through the state preparation. And compared to other methods, is your runtime is slower or faster than the others?
That is tricky to say without actually doing numerical simulations or running on a real quantum computer, because most algorithms, there's an asymptotic runtime bound, but the constants, if you actually want to know which is faster, they're all asymptotic in various different parameters. All of them asymptotic in the number of exponential in the number of qubits, always in there. But then there's a whole bunch of other parameters, like in some there's a mixing time of some Markov process, or some there's some. And so you'd actually have to compute this on a concrete case, which no one's done. And to do it, the best way is probably to simulate. So simulate, and some of these algorithms, I don't know of numerical simulations at any scale, but maybe they're out there. I haven't looked hard for the imaginary time evolution. There are some, but I'm not quite sure. For others, VQE, there's lots of numerical simulations and even running, but of course VQE is in practice faster and works better than this. But it's very different kind of trade-off in that with VQE, you get some output. Is it right or not? Let's hope so. But you've got no way, there's no guarantee that VQE will work at all, theoretically. This algorithm is provably succeeds, but might take a long time. VQE provably succeeds if you do it for such high depth you're doing the adiabatic state preparation. That's the intuition. But if you do what normally is meant by VQE, which is constant depth VQE, there's a guarantee that it won't always succeed, provably. But then the question is, does it work in practice? So in that, it depends. Constant depth VQE is, of course, much faster in terms of the quantum part, But then how long does it take to optimize, and how many optimization, outer optimization loop, how many, how long do you run the outer optimization loop? You set that in advance and hope that it is enough. In that sense, you can always run VQE, which is nice because you just set the parameters within the range you can actually implement. But then you've got no idea if the output is good or not. Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. So that's the trade-off with VQE, and that was sort of in my table of advantages and disadvantages. I didn't answer Graham's question. Maybe it's clear now, but why VQE, once you've trained up, optimized your circuit, then you can just run that circuit and generate ground states, assuming there's not too much noise every time. And that then just takes, if you're doing depth four VQE, that just takes depth four once you've trained. With this algorithm, because it's a probabilistic algorithm, to generate the ground state, even though I might stop on n zeros, so that's like coherence depth four, I have to run the entire thing from scratch, and it might take a million steps to see that again. And that's definitely a disadvantage to VQE. There are mitigations to that, because you might not, what are you doing with the quantum state? You're probably measuring some observable, but measuring some local observable will completely screw up the state, and so then rather than throwing it away, reconverging it with this algorithm might converge much faster and not take as many time steps to estimate a local observable. But there is a disadvantage. VQE is nice that once the circuit's trained, then you can just generate states, ground states, or hopefully generate ground states on demand. And that was the missing tick box.
Okay, thanks. We'll be a bit more here.